39 and 27. Do those numbers sound familiar at all to you? Those of you who teach Bible classes, you might be familiar with those numbers because you likely teach them to the children. Along with teaching them that there's two parts of the Bible. You have the Old Testament and you have the New Testament. And we teach our children there's 39 books in the Old Testament and there's 27 books in the New Testament. What I want to do the next couple nights is talk about the book of Isaiah. And I would suggest to you, while you're teaching your young people, or while we're learning in general about the Old Testament and the New Testament, we also recognize that Isaiah actually follows that same basic format. There are 39 chapters that primarily focus on judgment. God's judgment of Judah and Israel, the nations. And then there are 27 chapters, 40 through 66, that deal with hope, with restoration. A very easy breakdown. Now, one reason I think this is really important is because how extremely important Isaiah is to the New Testament. And we're going to see a little bit of that really the next three nights, because even when I preach on Romans 13 on Friday, we're going to be looking and pulling some things from Isaiah even as we do that, because part of what Paul's doing in Romans 13 relates to some things in the book of Isaiah, which is part of my point. And so we would really do ourselves a big favor when we're learning things about the Old Testament, the New Testament, and teaching our children all these details and facts, to really emphasize something that's so simple about the book of Isaiah that relates to the rest of the Bible. There's 66 chapters in Isaiah. There's 66 books in the Bible. And they break down exactly the same way. So why not go ahead and teach that to our children and help them begin seeing the patterns in the book of Isaiah? And we don't have time to go into depth on this, but hopefully you will recognize it through the sermons in the next few nights, that the New Testament writers, they frequently refer to and allude to all kinds of things in the book of Isaiah. It's really fundamental to 33% of the New Testament at least. And the reason I say that is because Luke, who wrote both Luke and Acts, he uses a pattern from the book of Isaiah to write both of those books. Paul actually does the same thing with Romans. Isaiah is an extremely important writer to the New Testament authors. And they're borrowing his ideas and his thoughts. They're looking at his prophecies so often that it's coming out in their writing, the things that they're saying about Jesus. We're going to do a little bit of that tonight as we're going to look at the first main section of Isaiah, chapter 7 through 12. Chapter 7 through 12, and the prophecy that Isaiah gives there. Now, tomorrow night, we're going to look more specifically at chapters 40 through 55, and then we're also going to look at chapter 61 because it relates. Now, we're not going to look at everything in these chapters, so don't worry, we're not going to be here for 2 hours. That's not what we're going to do. But I just want to pick out some of the highlights, some of the things that are going on in these prophecies, to help us understand a little bit more about what's happening in the book of Isaiah. And I'm just going to confess to you up front that there's going to be slightly more teaching type of material in what we're doing tonight and tomorrow night than maybe the previous nights in terms of the distinction between teaching and preaching that sometimes we make. Hopefully there'll be plenty of preaching in that as well. But I also want to teach some things, something that's really important, that we're teaching things about these books, that we really understand what's going on in them, and particularly the book of Isaiah. It's a really exciting book. There's a lot of really neat things about Isaiah when we understand the way he prophesies. It's not linear. And often the prophets are not linear. They're not just going from one thing to the next. It's better described more as like a collage, where they throw up various ideas, and you can kind of compare and see how they work together. And sometimes they do it in a very systematic way, but that's really a better way to imagine what the prophets are doing. Just like you think about maybe the sermons that Jason has preached recently here. He probably is not just sitting down one day and planning for the next 6 months a linear way to go through various parts of the Bible. Rather, he's probably picking out various themes and texts and ideas, and they mesh together, and it's more like a collage, and the prophets are like that. There are concerns, there are things that need to be addressed, and so they're addressing those things in pertinent situations. Think of Jeremiah. When he goes in Jeremiah 7 to the temple, there's going to be a specific type of message he's going to give in that setting. He's not worried about what happened in Jeremiah 6. Oh, this is written 30 years later, for one thing. But he's not worried about the previous material. That's not affecting what he's doing in Jeremiah 7. It has more to do with the audience and the setting he's in. And so think of that collage-type format. Now, there are segments and sections that go together. And so what we have here in Isaiah 7 through 11, and hopefully I can point out to you some interesting things in this text that maybe you haven't seen before. And if you have, I commend you, because I haven't heard them a lot in my life, but they're extremely helpful in understanding what Isaiah is doing. The first of those is that he uses a child as a sign in this entire section, from 7 all the way through 11. In chapter 7, he does it. In chapter 8, he does it. In chapter 9, he does it. Chapter 10, he uses a child as a sign. They're counting the trees after the destruction of God, the wrath being outpoured upon the Assyrians. It's part of this analogy he's using. And then in chapter 11, he's using a child as a sign. And so we need to see these patterns that are happening and not merely just pull from the Old Testament and turn it into some New Testament teaching. That's where we ultimately go. That's where these texts ultimately lead, and the New Testament writers do use them, but it's really important that we understand what they're doing in their setting and in their time. So I want us to begin in chapter 7, and some of what I want to do tonight is really just quickly overview what's happening in the section from 7 through 11, and then even 12, because 12 is a song of deliverance. It's focusing on what God has done. But I want to point out a few things for you tonight from that text. And then we're going to go back and talk about what's happening in this text. What the text is talking about. The point that it's making about the Messiah to come. And how that is going to play out eventually through Jesus. That's the ultimate conclusion to this. So in chapter 7, this is a text that you are likely familiar with because Matthew quotes it. That the virgin will conceive and give birth to a son. And she will call his name Emmanuel. Unfortunately, too often the discussion stops right there and go immediately to Matthew and begin talking about how this connects to Jesus. And certainly it does connect to Jesus, but we need to understand that Asa also has an initial fulfillment. And sometimes we get concerned, especially about the word virgin, because Matthew uses this term to talk about the miracle that takes place at Jesus' birth. But one thing we need to understand here is that in Hebrew, this just means young woman. It just means young woman. Now, when the Septuagint writers come along, they use the word parthenos, which means virgin. So they change the word here to some degree. It still has a very similar type of meaning, but it's more specific, likely because they understood it had messianic implications. But in Hebrew, it is much more general. And likely what's happening here is Isaiah is speaking to a woman who is present. He's pointing out someone in the room here with Ahaz and with the others saying, she is going to conceive and give birth to a son, and you will call his name Emmanuel. Now, you might be shocked by this. You might be thinking, how could this be the case? And if that's true, I want to prove to you that that is the case. The concern here in Isaiah 7 is that Syria and Israel are coming against Judah and Jerusalem. And Ahaz is worried here. He's going out to check the water supply because he's worried about the siege that's going to take place. That Syria and Israel, they wanted Judah to join with them against Assyria, but it appears that either Jerusalem has already made an alliance with Assyria or they're going to make an alliance with Assyria. And so Syria, now there's Syria and Assyria, so let's not get those mixed up. Syria and Israel are upset about this. And so they say, we're going to come and we're going to destroy you and we're going to put our own king in place of Ahaz. And then we're going to war with Assyria and try to defend ourselves against Assyria. So Isaiah is sent to Ahaz and he brings his child with him. And his child is already being introduced here as a sign. And he tells them, you're going to have this sign. Ahaz won't ask for one. He says, I'm going to give you one anyway. The virgin will be with child and bear a son. She will call his name Emmanuel. But I want you to listen to what's said after this, okay? He will eat curds and honey at the time he knows enough to refuse evil and choose good. For before the boy will know enough to refuse evil and choose good, the land whose two kings you dread will be forsaken. Now, I understand that there is a later concept tied to this text about conceiving and giving birth to a son. But the reality is, if we read the text closely, we understand there's going to be an initial fulfillment right here, that this child is going to be born, and before he knows how to call good and evil, the two nations that they're afraid of are going to be brought down by God. That's the message. That's the sign. And then if we go to chapter 8, we're ultimately going to spend most of our time tonight in chapter 9 and chapter 11, but I want to get us there first. When we go to chapter 8, in verse 1, the Lord said to me, "Take for yourself a large tablet and write on it in ordinary letters. Swift is the booty, speedy is the prey." Or it might say, "Maher Shalal Hashbaz." That's a name. Okay, so it might be either one of those in your translation. "I will take to myself faithful witnesses for testimony, Uriah the priest and Zechariah the son of Jeberechiah." So I approached the prophetess, and she conceived and gave birth to a son. Notice the wording. It is identical to chapter 7. "Then the Lord said to me, 'Name him Maher Shalal Hashbaz.'" So he's told to give this child a certain name. Verse 4, "For before the boy knows how to cry out, 'My father or my mother,' the wealth of Damascus and the spoil of Samaria will be carried away before the king of Assyria." Now, if you drop down to a couple more pertinent verses that I want to look at, verse 8 and then verse 10, it says, "Then it will sweep on into Judah. It will overflow and pass through. It will reach even to the neck, and the spread of its wings will fill the breadth of your land, O Emmanuel. Devise a plan," it says in verse 10, "but it will be thwarted. State a proposal, but it will not stand, for Emmanuel." Or it might say, "God is with us." He's making a point here using these names. The names are important. They're significant to the message of the text. And you go from 7 all the way to 11. Well, one of the key messages, especially in 7 and 8, chapter 7 and 8, is this idea of the name he uses in the beginning, Emmanuel. God is with us. He wants Ahaz, first of all, to recognize that if he would trust in God and realize Emmanuel, that God is with us, that God would deliver him, and God is in fact going to deliver him. He says, "I'm going to do this despite the fact that you don't believe. I'm going to bring down Syria, and I'm going to bring down Israel. I'm going to show you that I'm with you." And when you get toward the second part of chapter 8, there's also kind of a negative connotation to this reality. The positive connotation is, "I'm with you. I'm going to bring down these two nations you dread." But the negative side of it is, "I'm also with you, and you don't trust me, and so you're going to be judged." That's the point Isaiah is making in 7 and 8. And that's the point of the name Emmanuel. That's the significance of these children being signs. The child he professes is going to take place in chapter 7. And then the identical language in chapter 8, which is his child, which is now being used for the same purpose. To say that before these nations, before this child gets of any kind of age, these nations are going to be brought down. Okay, now, we're seeing this pattern in 7 and 8, where 7 and 8 and 9 and 10 and 11 are going to go together. And I can't cover it all, but mostly I want you to see that there is an initial context to what's happening here in 7 and 8. It's about Syria, it's about Damascus, and it's about Samaria or Israel, and that they're going to be judged. And it's also about Ahaz, the reality that he's going to be judged and his people are ultimately going to be judged because they don't trust that God is with them. That's the point of Emmanuel. Now, there is significance to this concept and this idea about the restoration of God and God's plan being accomplished, which is why Matthew uses it later. But there is this initial fulfillment that's taking place here in 7 and 8 in the context, in the time period of Isaiah and the people discussed here. Now, let me stop for a minute because this pertains to what we're doing tonight and tomorrow night and just make this statement. There are very few, I used to say there were none, but I've changed my view of this a little bit. There are very few prophecies in the Old Testament that only pertain to the Messiah. Almost all of them have initial fulfillments, and then they have a dual fulfillment that happens later by the person of Jesus Christ, and he fulfills these in a more full way. And so we need to understand what's going on here in these texts to gain some insight and gain some knowledge about the point being made here before we jump to the New Testament. This point about Emmanuel is really important. This idea that we trust in God, that we depend on Him, that we put our faith in Him. That's an extremely important point that Isaiah is trying to make to Ahaz, that if we just jump right to chapter 7 and go to Matthew, we miss that whole context of what's happening here. And he's using these children as signs to make sure everyone understands. He's making these predictions about what's going to happen in their lifetime. They're going to see it with their own eyes, and they'll not be able to deny the power of God taking place before them. Now, when we get to chapter 9, I believe the horizon, the time horizon, is beginning to expand. Now, what I mean by that is, in 7 and 8, it is much more immediate. And this is the nature of how Isaiah prophesies. And so again, I want to do some teaching here about what's going on in Isaiah's prophecy. He tends to begin with the immediate context. He tends to begin with things that are going to happen now. And as his prophecies progress, the time horizon begins to expand further out. When we get to chapter 9, and certainly when we get to chapter 11, chapter 11 is a text that I believe only has messianic fulfillment. It's one of the few. But I want you to see how he's extending his time horizon as he makes these prophecies. When we get to chapter 9, he says in verse 1, "But there will be no more gloom for her who is in anguish. In earlier times he treated the land of Zebulun and the land of Naphtali with contempt, but later on he shall make it glorious by the way of the sea, on the other side of the Jordan, Galilee of the Gentiles." Zebulun and Naphtali border Gentile territory, and so that's what he's talking about there. "The people who walk in darkness will see a great light. Those who live in a dark land, the light will shine on them. You shall multiply the nation. You shall increase their gladness. They shall be glad in your presence, as with the gladness of the harvest, as men rejoice when they divide the spoil. For you shall break the yoke of their burden and the staff on their shoulders, the rod of their oppressor, as at the battle of Midian. For every boot of the booted warrior in the battle tumult and cloak rolled in blood will be for burning, fuel for the fire. For a child will be born to us, a son will be given to us, and the government will rest on his shoulders. And his name will be called Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Eternal Father, Prince of Peace. There will be no end to the increase of his government or of peace on the throne of David and over his kingdom, to establish it and to uphold it with justice and righteousness from then on and forevermore. The zeal of the Lord of the hosts will accomplish this." Just a powerful passage. One of the things I want to point out to you, and I can't develop it fully, but I'm going to go point by point through it real quickly here, is that chapter 9 is actually reversing what's happening at the end of chapter 8. At the end of chapter 8, they have no light. Okay, he says, "To the law and to the testimony, if they do not speak according to this word, it's because they have no dawn," or "they have no light." That's verse 21. "They're hard-pressed, they're famished, they're hungry. They will pass through the land," it says in verse 21, "hard-pressed and famished. It will turn out that when they are hungry, they will be enraged and curse their king and their God as they face upward. Then they will look to the earth and behold distress and darkness, the gloom of anguish, and they will be driven away into darkness." So there's four things here. They have no light, they're hard-pressed, they curse their king and their God, and darkness prevails. And what happens in the transition between 8 and 9 is they have a great light. Verse 2, "The people who walk in darkness will see a great light. They multiply and rejoice. You shall multiply the nations," verse 3. "You shall increase their gladness. They praise their king and their God. And he upholds justice and righteousness. They prevail." So again, he's showing the destruction that's going to come upon Judah and Jerusalem because of their wickedness, because of their evil. But there's going to be this child who's going to be born. And he's going to reverse all of that. He's going to reign as king. The government is going to rest upon his shoulders, it says. This is a kingdom that's being established. He's going to restore what was lost to them in this darkness that they live in right now, where they curse the king and they curse God. This figure, this child that's going to be born, he's going to reverse all of that. In chapter 11, it says, "Then a shoot will spring forth from the stem of Jesse, and a branch from his roots will bear fruit. The Spirit of the Lord will rest on him, the Spirit of wisdom and understanding, the Spirit of counsel and strength, the Spirit of knowledge and the fear of the Lord, and he will delight in the fear of the Lord." I'm going to save some of this text for tomorrow night and focus more on chapter 9, but I do want you to see something in verse 6 and following, because it's a restoration of Eden. It is the restoring of paradise, and this is one reason I think it's only fulfilled in Jesus. And the wolf will dwell with the lamb, and the leopard will lie down with the young goat, and the calf and the young lion, and the fatling together, and a little boy will lead them. You see how he keeps using this child, this little boy, this person that's being born, that's going to change everything. There's a pattern to what Isaiah is doing here as he's making these prophecies. And what chapter 11 is about is restoring what was lost in the garden. That pattern follows throughout Scripture in a very strong way, all the way to Revelation, actually. That this dwelling with God that was lost in the garden is then ultimately going to be restored, and it's only done through Jesus Christ. And so I believe chapter 11 is one text, for various reasons that I might talk more about tomorrow night, in which I believe is only fulfilled in the Messiah. But I believe what we can see with the rest of our time tonight is what is the nature of this kingdom. What is the nature of Jesus, who's going to reign as king, who is reigning now as king? What is his kingdom going to be like? And how does it differ from how we perceive kingdoms or how they experienced kingdoms? Now, let me say this from the very beginning of what is experienced by these people, whether it's Judah or Israel or the nations around them. One of the greatest sins that you're going to find if you begin reading through the prophets is that they neglect the widow and the orphan. They defile justice. They are unrighteous. These are the types of sins that are being created by the people at the top, by those who are supposed to be ruling with justice and righteousness. And these terms, by the way, in the Old Testament, particularly in Isaiah, when he uses justice and righteousness, they are royal-type terms. We don't always get the significance of the terms being used in translation. But when he says justice and righteousness, and you see that in the book of Isaiah, this is tied to how a king rules his people with justice and equity, how he guides his people in righteousness. The terms are specific to royalty and how they rule. And so this is why I've been talking all week about the significance of the idea of kingdom in Scripture. It's all over the place in Isaiah. It's a very important part of the message Isaiah is giving, that this child who's going to be born, the government's going to rest on his shoulders. He's going to rule in justice and righteousness. All of this points to the coming of God's kingdom. This is a promise that they would have understood in a very real way, because what they experienced were earthly kings who did not uphold any of this. Very often they were evil kings doing things for their own benefit. And for that reason, in places like Ezekiel 34, it talks about these shepherds of Israel, how they fatten themselves and they don't feed the sheep and they run over the sheep and they don't take care of them. And so he's going to send one shepherd, one sheep, David. It's a prediction of restoration, much like what's going on here. And so I want us to talk about what is the nature of this coming king. Three ideals that define the messianic kingdom. That's what I want us to talk about tonight. Three things that help us understand what this kingdom is going to be all about. The first of those is that it is a kingdom of strength. It is a kingdom of power and strength that is unparalleled by anything else seen in the ancient world or in our current world. And the way in which this is portrayed within these passages is the idea of deliverance. The people will walk in darkness, it says. They will see a great light. Those who live in a dark land, the light will shine on them. He's going to bring deliverance to them. And the message and the concept of chapters 9 and 11, I think, are conveyed in a really strong way in Isaiah 42. Now, this idea we're going to get to a little bit more strongly with Isaiah 42 and 59 tomorrow night. But I want you to see this text here and how this is portrayed for us, that the Lord is going to come with vengeance. He is this divine warrior. This is the kind of king that people always want, and he is going to fulfill this in a very big way. The Lord will go forth like a warrior. He will arouse his zeal like a man of war. He will utter a shout. Yes, he will raise a war cry. He will prevail against his enemies. Now, Isaiah 9 is just a little bit more wordy with all of this. It's not so concise in the way it's described. So, for instance, in verse 4, "For you shall break the yoke of their burden and the staff on their shoulders, the rod of their oppressor, as at the battle of Midian." What's going to be the nature of this kingdom is the reality of the king, this child he's about to talk about. He is going to come and he's going to break the burden. He's going to remove the oppressor. He's going to deliver them. And now he is going to reign supreme. He's going to be the one ruling over them. And so the nature of this kingdom is one in which it's going to be great strength and power and deliverance and salvation. All concepts and ideas that Isaiah talks about frequently. But he's not the only one that discusses this. The psalmists understand this reality as well. They are very in touch with what the ideal king is supposed to look like, even though Saul and David and Hezekiah and Josiah, they had great hopes for them. They never really fulfilled all of this. But in their mind, they understand what this king is supposed to be like. In Psalm 45, it says in verse 3, speaking, these are words to the king, it tells us. Verses to the king, it says in verse 1, gird your sword on your thigh, O mighty one. In your splendor, in your majesty, and in your majesty, ride on victoriously for the cause of truth and meekness and righteousness. Let your right hand teach you awesome things. Your arrows are sharp. The peoples fall under you. Your arrows are in the heart of the king's enemies. Your throne, O God, is forever and ever. A scepter of uprightness is the scepter of your kingdom. You have loved righteousness and hated wickedness. Therefore, God, your God, has anointed you with the oil of joy above your fellows. You're familiar with this text because it's quoted in Hebrews, being spoken of about Jesus. It's a messianic text. It's about the nature of his kingdom. And the New Testament does not shy away from this kind of imagery. You may be familiar with Revelation chapter 19. It is a text that is speaking very much like some of these in Isaiah, emphasizing Jesus coming with power and authority. And he is going to come and he is going to destroy all the kingdoms. The armies which are in heaven, verse 14, clothed in fine linen, white and clean, were following him on white horses. From his mouth comes a sharp sword, so that with it he may strike down the nations, and he will rule them with a rod of iron. That's from Psalm 2, the allusion is at least. And he treads the winepress of the fierce wrath of God the Almighty. And on his robe and on his thigh he has a name written, King of Kings and Lord of Lords. I don't want us to miss how in all of these texts, there is the emphasis on the name given. Remember that in Isaiah 7, you shall call him Emmanuel. Or in Isaiah 8, he tells him, you shall call him, and he gives him a name he's supposed to call him. This is a common pattern, and it's about the accomplishment of God's will. It's about God's authority and his reign and the power that he has. This is a sign to them so they understand God is with them. And that's what's going on here in Revelation 19. This is a triumphal entry. He has destroyed the nations, and now he is coming and parading his victory before all. And his dominance before the world. Isaiah actually predicts this in Isaiah chapter 60. He pictures what is the strength of God's kingdom and the power of his might. And these texts, like Revelation 19, are taking and extending the idea of what we see here in places like Psalm 45 or Isaiah 9 and 11. So one of the things that we've seen throughout this week, really, especially Sunday, and what we're talking about here from Isaiah 9, is the strength of the messianic kingdom, the power that's going to come when Jesus is reigning. And there's nothing that can stand in his way. It doesn't matter if it's Assyria, or if it's Babylon, or if it's Egypt. What's being described here in Isaiah, especially when you get to chapters 13 and following, is God's judgment on the nations. And there's no one who's going to be able to withstand his fury. He is a consuming fire, Isaiah says numerous times. And he will bring his wrath on those who do not subject themselves to him. The second ideal. The first one is the reality that he is a deliverer, that his kingdom is defined by strength. The second way to define this kingdom is it's by its civility. It is a kingdom of strength, but it is also a kingdom of civility. And this is brought forth by the idea of justice and righteousness, how they're used in all of these texts in Isaiah 9 and Isaiah 11, and really in the broad spectrum all throughout the book of Isaiah. He keeps talking about justice and righteousness. You remember he talks in chapter 11 about how these things are going to be part of his garments. It's like he's wearing justice. He's wearing righteousness. That's how much of a part of this messianic figure it is. It's like the clothes he has on. Now compare that to what they're used to. What they've seen and what they've experienced from those who are supposed to be ruling them and leading them. And the injustice and the unrighteousness that really defined kingdoms like Assyria and Babylon and even Israel and Judah. And what God wants to emphasize through Isaiah is that this child who's going to come is going to be born into the world, who's going to be given to us by God, Isaiah 9 and verse 6. He's going to be a wonderful counselor, a mighty God. He's going to uphold justice and righteousness. That phrase, mighty God, might make more sense to us. Actually, more literally, it could be translated hero God. Does that resonate a little bit more with you? The message that's being given there. And he's a hero. He's one who's come to deliver. He's the one, he defends the helpless. He defends the widow and the orphan. He does all the things that are talked about in the Old Testament that these kings were supposed to do, that they were supposed to uphold, but they didn't. But this child, upon whom his government's going to rest on his shoulders, he brings peace. He sits on the throne of David, and he's going to uphold justice and righteousness, it says in verse 7. The Spirit of the Lord himself will rest upon him, it tells us in chapter 11, verses 2 and following. Isaiah portrays a king who is going to unite God's people. I want you to see this in the text because it's really important and it's interesting. These are some of the things in the stories. Sometimes the way we read Scripture, we miss some things that are really significant. In the story of Joseph, when his brothers take him and they throw him in the pit and they initially want to kill him, who is it that wants to get rid of him? Well, it's Judah. Reuben had acted vilely already and gone into one of his father's wives, and so he was written off. Okay, he's not going to get the double portion. He's gone. Simeon, you remember him and Levi, they went into Shechem and his people after they had circumcised themselves by their order, and he destroyed them and again brought shame upon Jacob, and he's concerned about this. They're written off. So the next in line is Judah. Now at this point in the ancient Near East, the patriarch, the father, he can choose who he wants to be the firstborn. There's plenty of evidence of this. When things have gone this way, it's up to him now who's going to be the next patriarch of the family. But ultimately now it comes down to Judah and, of course, Joseph, because Joseph is his favorite. He's got the coat of many colors. He is the chosen one. And so it's to Judah's advantage if he can get rid of Joseph, because he's the next in line. Now, one thing that's also interesting about this is who's trying to advocate for Joseph. Do you remember that? Reuben, right? He's the one kind of written off, maybe trying to get back in his father's good graces. He says, no, don't do this. He wants them to wait. He doesn't want to be held responsible for this, and maybe he can get back in Jacob's good graces if he delivers Joseph from this. His plan, remember, was to come back and get Joseph out. And of course, the whole plan goes awry for him when he is sold into slavery. But if we read the story carefully, what then happens at this point is that there is animosity now between Ephraim, who is the son of Joseph, and Judah. And that animosity remains all throughout Israel's history. In fact, you have the northern nation, which is pretty much made up of Ephraim and Manasseh, against Judah. There is this division that takes place from the beginning, from Genesis, from this story. And it's brought out in Ezekiel. You remember you have the two sticks, the stick of Ephraim and the stick of Judah, and they're eventually brought together. Why is he making this point? And now in Isaiah, notice what happens here. this branch of Jesse, he is going to bring unity to the people of God. Verse 13 of chapter 11, then the jealousy of Ephraim will depart, and those who harass Judah will be cut off. Ephraim will not be jealous of Judah, and Judah will not harass Ephraim. They're going to be brought back together. This child is going to bring unity to the people of God. And together they will plunder Edom and Moab. They're going to bring the rest of the world in subjection to them. And there'll be a highway from Assyria, verse 16, for the remnant of his people who will be left, just as there was from Israel in the day that they came up out of the land of Egypt. That Exodus imagery again. When this son comes, he's going to deliver the people of God in such a way that it's just like Moses when he brought them out of Egypt. There's going to be this unity. They're going to go out together. He's going to bring them all back together again, and he's going to rule them with civility, with justice, and with righteousness. But the final of these third concepts, which, by the way, are extremely important in any type of ancient kingdom, the way they would have viewed their kings, the idea that he is strong, the idea that he is civil. These are important ideas to the ancient Near East in terms of who their leaders are and their kings. And Jesus is going to embody all of these as the one who fulfills these prophecies. The last of these is the sustainability of his power. What is the greatest concern for kingdoms? I mean, what is it that's bothering Pharaoh in this story early on? He's worried that Israel is going to grow strong and they're going to revolt against him and he's going to lose his power. What is it that Syria, Damascus, and Samaria, Israel, what is it that they're worried about? They're worried about Assyria coming in and taking away their kingdom. Sustainability is extremely important to the idea of the power of a kingdom. And what this text says about the Messiah is that not only is he strong, and not only is he civil, but also he is sustainable. He's going to last forever. It says in chapter 9, toward the end of our reading, on the throne of David and over his kingdom, to establish it and to uphold it with justice and righteousness, that's the civility, from then on and forevermore. There's nothing that will stop him. He is that figure in Revelation 19 who's coming with vengeance on all the kings who stand against him. And in fact, the picture goes into greater detail. Ezekiel uses the same kind of imagery, but in Revelation, John borrows the concept, this kind of stock imagery about God's judgment. It says he's going to strew their dead bodies all over the ground to feed the birds of the air. That's the level of his dominance and his power and sustainability. Not only can they not stand in his way, he will utterly destroy them. He will crush them like a potter's vessel, as we talked about from Psalm 2. He will rule them with a rod of iron. And so all of this relates to the nature of the Messianic kingdom. Now, most of this relates to Isaiah 9 and 11, what I've talked about tonight, and how it portrays Jesus and his kingdom. But when we get into the New Testament, places like Matthew chapter 1, where he talks about Jesus' birth, and he highlights Isaiah 7. Or in Luke, where it talks about him being son of the Most High God. All of these texts are signaling the reality that this child who is born, Jesus, the son of Mary, he is now the fulfillment of all these promises of the Old Testament. And just like the proclamation of God at Jesus' birth and at his transfiguration, we better listen to him. This is my beloved son, he says. Listen to him. Just as the Hebrew writer says in Hebrews chapter 1, God has spoken at various times and in various ways, but in these last days, he has spoken to us through his Son, who's sitting at his right hand in power. And so all of this relates, the things that we're talking about and trying to understand the kingdom of God, what it relates to is asking this question. Is he the king of my life? do I understand that Emmanuel, God is with us? Or like Ahaz, am I denying that? Am I trying to get away from the influence of God? Am I trying to deny his power? If I am, I'm going to be very disappointed. Because God is with us whether we are with him or not. He will be with us for good, or he will be with us for bad, for judgment. That's what Ahaz failed to understand. But it's the message that Isaiah hopes we understand. There's no getting away from the influence and the power and the might and the strength of the Messiah. There's no way to sidestep his justice and his equity. And there's no hope that his reign will ever end. There's no getting away from him. And so it becomes up to us to make a decision. Are we going to follow him, or are we going to rebel against him? Jesus has told us very clearly in his own words in the Gospels recorded for us, and through the words of his apostles, whom he gave the Holy Spirit to, what he expects from us. He expects us to give up our lives and to follow him, to dedicate ourselves to his cause and to his kingdom. And if we aren't willing to do that, then we're not on his side. There's only two options. We're either in his kingdom or we're not, and there's nothing in between. And you might realize tonight that you aren't in his kingdom. Maybe it's because you've chosen to go other directions. Maybe it's like Ahaz, it's all there before you, but you've just denied the power. And tried to see it from another way, and tried to make alliances with the world, and tried to get help from other people, rather than realizing that strength and power is only in Jesus Christ. And if that's the case, it's not too late. You can still learn the message of Isaiah 7 through 11, that God is with us, and experience that in a very positive way, in a way of submission to his will. And whether it's that you need to be baptized into Christ to enter his kingdom, or whether it's you need to repent and turn your life around to begin living in his kingdom aright again, the message of hope tonight is it's not too late to do that. You can do it now. You can make that change tonight and begin living right again. Can we help you do that? Why don't you come as we stand and we sing together?